This is Pamela Kuhn, and the curtain is now up on Center Stage, the show about the arts and the artists behind their work. Advocacy is at its most effective when it starts at the community level. This is a statement from the League of American Orchestras, a foundation that is dedicated to the training, resources, and support for professional orchestral musicians. The strength of every professional musician's existence right now has been affected by the support of groups like the League of American Orchestras in some fashion. The future of orchestral music is held in dramatic jeopardy as we continue to traverse through the limitations that COVID-19 has presented to us. The League of American Orchestras is just one example of a contributing body of knowledge that can help orchestras survive through the coronavirus and help to preserve the future of public musical performances. I am a professional musician. I could never have predicted how quickly my life work would be taken from me during this pandemic. But let me remind us all that the world of entertainment is a source that we do take for granted. When orchestras, opera houses, and Broadway theaters closed on March 13th, it was a dark day for every performing artist that depended on their job as a means of supporting themselves and forwarding their careers. And it still remains a dark day for the public, whose lives were suddenly deprived of performances worldwide. So, with my reference to the League of American Orchestras comment about community strength, I have turned to my old friend and colleague, Robert Chinante, Executive Director of the Waterbury Symphony in Waterbury, Connecticut, to discuss the relevance of music in our lives and the steps we must take now to preserve its beauty and preservation forever. Robert Chinante, welcome to Center Stage. It's always such a pleasure to have you.
Thanks, Pam. Great to see you.
I'm just thrilled to see you smiling. And for all my listeners out there in radio land, we are on a Zoom conversation, which will eventually be put up at centerstagewithpamelakuhn.com and on YouTube. Robert, you and I as singers, I mean, we have a kindred spirit. And
yes.
I did think of you on that March 13th, at that Black Friday, when it seemed that all artistic endeavors shut their doors. It was a shocking day, and I'm just wondering how you handled it. Were you seeing it coming? And how did you react on behalf of the Waterbury Symphony Orchestra?
Well, Pam, thank you again for having me. And it's great to see you, although I wish I could be in the studio with you. But I think it's wonderful that thanks to the modern technology, we're able to be together here through Zoom and on the radio.
Absolutely.
March 13th, it was interesting. It all sort of hit me at once. It was, you sort of knew it was coming, but when it actually came, it felt very sudden.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I think I was mentally preparing and trying to set certain things in place at the symphony, I think even prior to March 13th, you mentioned the League of American Orchestras, and they were a group that started putting information out there. I think nobody knew, though, prior to even on March 13th, the gravity of what we were about to face. The way I look at that period is what was key was just jumping into action.
Mm-hmm.
There was really no time to waste. I felt that time was precious, and I think it was important to be very proactive. The first thing I did was communicating with my staff, communicating with our board of directors, really getting our stakeholders in contact, really bringing all these people into the discussion that were key. For me, in any crisis situation, communication is so important. And I feel so we really opened the channels of communication. And we were in touch with stakeholders like the League of American Orchestras, and they have been invaluable throughout this process. I cannot imagine getting through this without the support and the resources and advocacy that the League of American Orchestras has provided on behalf of orchestras like ours. So and I'll tell you, the first thing that we did, which was also integral to sort of reacting during this period, was our board really getting together, and our executive committee in particular coming together. They became a real source of strength and guidance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. That's we have to depend on that right now. We have to depend on the whole private sector coming forward to really strengthen, you know, everyone's actions from here on out. So your orchestra, the Waterbury Symphony, is one of the oldest on the East Coast. I mean, it's a wonderful thing, and established for many, many years. You have so much integrity, and you have the fortune, the good fortune of actually having quite a good endowment fund, I understand.
Yeah, and having a good endowment fund definitely gives a certain feeling of stability to an organization. Our endowment is larger than the size of our annual budget. By the same token, you know, an endowment only goes so far because it's so important to be a good fiscal steward of that endowment. And I think that's one of the tough things that many organizations are facing right now. You know, we talk about sort of the rainy day fund. Well, the rainy day has definitely come. But we not only have to get through this period, we really have to prepare for the future, because there will be a day when arts organizations can come back. And I think it's important that we're in a position to come back. So we've really had to take every step possible to ensure the financial well-being of the orchestra while still keeping everyone employed. And providing relief to our musicians, which was an early effort that we took to provide relief to them. Not, you know, nothing that was of great, great significance, but something that we felt was really important, you know, just to provide some level of relief, even if it wasn't anywhere near what they would be losing, you know, in what they were used to from the services from the Waterbury Symphony Orchestra. We were also very lucky to benefit from some of the programs that you hear about through the CARES Act. Some of those relief programs have really been lifelines for us during this period.
That's fantastic. Yeah. You know, it's incredible to think about some of our counterparts in Europe who have the good fortune of having the government help them survive. You know, they immediately came into action because they are considered to be essentials, but they're actually considered to be more than essential workers. You know, here, it's been actually the most revelatory thing to me during all of this has been the realization that we've suddenly realized as musicians, we're not essential. And I find that so hard to wrestle with, Robert. I mean, how have you been able to adjust that or get your head around that?
Yeah, you know, you bring up a good point, because while I'm very grateful for the relief we've received thus far, my concern is about what lies ahead, and I don't see a plan yet. I don't know if there will be one in terms of government relief for arts organizations. Arts organizations and artists alike need help. You know, our businesses, we can't reopen right now. There's no, you know, a lot of sectors are struggling, but some of those sectors have been able to make up some lost ground. As you know, there's no concerts going on. There's no summer festivals. So I really need to see, you know, what is the plan moving forward in terms of the arts being essential. You know, I think one of the things that strikes me is we're not viewed necessarily as essential workers. But yet, I think the arts are so essential. I can't imagine personally, and I think many people feel this way, being able to get through a period like this without the arts. Think about the role that music and literature and art have played for so many people in terms of coping during these unprecedented times. So it's interesting, because we're not viewed as essential workers, and our art form is not necessarily viewed as an essential sector, I think, to a certain degree. But there's definitely an essentiality to what we're doing, I think, in terms of sustaining the human spirit.
Well, as I said in my intro, we all take the entertainment industry, for granted. You know, this is something we look to when we look at Netflix, and Hollywood is not producing right now. I mean, you know, there are photographers who can't produce right now. I mean, I'm going beyond musicians. The fact that we take away a livelihood that is essential to New York City life, which is Broadway theater and the orchestras and the opera, is almost unheard of. Now, for those who are really wanting, you know, let's talk about how you are keeping your musicians employed. Let's talk about that for a minute, and how a small orchestra like yourself is really willing to take that on and form your educational programs, et cetera. Clue us in, Robert Chinante.
Sure. It's sort of on two fronts. You mentioned education programs, so I'll start there. Mm-hmm. We've pivoted to provide a lot of our education programs virtually. Our Bravo Waterbury program, which is an after-school El Sistema program, within a week or two shifted to providing online content to maintain that link with our families. But one of the other exciting initiatives, we have a musical literacy program called Creating Musical Readers, and we sort of took an extension of that with Saint-Saëns' Carnival of Animals.
Beautiful.
And this is a piece that I hope many of your listeners know. It's a great introduction to the orchestra for young people. We were slated to perform this both on our subscription series and as an outreach program for the Waterbury Public Schools. And all that disappeared, obviously, because those were slated for March and May. Mm-hmm. But we said, is there a way that we could still deliver this and still reach the students and reach young people? Mm-hmm. So we actually repurposed the Carnival of Animals as a video series, taking each movement apart. Each movement is about a different instrument, a different animal relating to an instrument, and having each video basically take on a life of its own, featuring a different member of our orchestra, and each movement narrated by our music director and conductor, Leif Bjaaland. So also giving him a role during this time when he, you know, conductors can't take the podium. So I think we were also trying to reimagine his creativity and how we could best use his artistic energy. So that's on the educational side. On the performance side, I think we dipped our toe in the water a bit, and we've been getting more and more comfortable with virtual performances. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. One of the downsides, we didn't have a lot of archival content that we could grab. We did have some that we were able to put up, but we didn't, you know, it's not like the Metropolitan Opera where they have all these broadcasts they can go to, or the New York Philharmonic, and there's, you know, multiple organizations that have a sort of breadth and depth of broadcast material. We didn't have that, but we saw that as an opportunity to start creating. And again, to employ not only our musicians, but former guest artists who have appeared with the symphony, to try to give them opportunities, knowing that, you know, again, musicians as a whole, artists as a whole, their whole livelihood has really been compromised. So we've done several virtual concerts already. Mm-hmm. I still have some decorations up behind me on the wall for those of you watching the video from our virtual 4th of July concert. And we followed very much the model of the Metropolitan Opera's At Home Gala. We had different artists coming to us from their homes to perform a concert that really celebrated America's multicultural musical identity. It wasn't just an hour of patriotic music. We included some spirituals in there. We included a piece by Francis Johnson, who was a predecessor, African-American composer, predecessor to John Philip Sousa, led the first American tour to Europe of a band. And now we're heading into our next virtual program, which is focusing on women composers. And that concert is, just giving a little plug, Saturday, August 15th, 7:30. We've been doing these on YouTube. We find that YouTube is a great way to reach people. There's a certain mm-hmm. level of comfort and mm-hmm. familiarity with that. Part of why we're choosing August is because we are coming up on the centennial of the last state. Was August 18th, 1920, to ratify the 19th Amendment, giving women the right to vote. So we're helping to celebrate that with three centuries of music by women composers.
Ah.
One of the experiments, Pam, that we tried with our 4th of July concert, and luckily it went well, is something I think a lot of organizations are looking at right now, which is how do we monetize these programs? It's great to offer this. It's great to be relevant. But at the end of the day, we have bills to pay and we need to sustain ourselves mm-hmm. as an organization. So we did, for the first time, try charging. We sold tickets to the event. We also had corporate sponsorship, which helped. Our sponsors and our donors have been so incredibly generous during this entire period. And we exceeded our goal. And it gave us a feeling of hope that this is a model that we can use during this period when we're not able to be in person. But even when people are starting to come back, I don't think it's going to be quite like, you know, flicking a light switch on. Mm-hmm. I think this has helped us to become more innovative and creative about how we're going to reach audience members.
And the way forward, isn't it? I mean, we...
I think so.
As you said, we've had online for a while. And for the big orchestras, it's one thing. They have a lot of money to play with and a lot of, mm-hmm. of experts in the background guiding this. Would you say at this point that maybe being a small orchestra has its advantages for you in this way?
I think so, because I think being a small orchestra in many ways, a small regional orchestra, mm-hmm. allows us to be nimble in mm-hmm. many ways that perhaps a larger organization would not be.
That's really interesting, because I know that there are several small orchestras besides yourselves that have actually come out of this okay, that have been able to keep their musicians employed. And let's get down to it. This is the most important thing, isn't it? Because mm-hmm. none of us are going to exist without being able to pay the rent. And this has yep. been something that really just flooded onto the heads of every musician and performer in the world, not just here.
Yep.
But it has lingered yeah. with America longer than anywhere else. You know, in Germany and in Spain, they are starting performances now. They're being very cautious. Denmark has been working through this entire time and wow. being very clever at getting performances outside and really increasing the online presence. So let's mm-hmm. talk about this demographic. You say that YouTube is easier to negotiate, you know. I think there's a certain age group that would disagree with you. And maybe those people are your donors and have been for a long time. Is the world changing, and are we actually encouraging them to come along with the world?
I think so. I think so. It's interesting you bring that up. We did our first virtual concert on Zoom. And I found that was actually a lot hard. There were certain mm-hmm. technological disadvantages to Zoom. Is great for a conversation like this. It's great for meetings. It's. I mean, I use it basically every day, I think, with my work. But in terms of a concert, it presented limitations.
Yeah.
But I also think for especially our older patrons, there's less familiarity with Zoom than there is something like YouTube.
Okay.
I think because YouTube's been around now for... Gosh, how long is it? Maybe is it quite 2 decades?
I actually don't know. Huh, that's an interesting
question. It seems like it's always been a part of life. So I feel like actually many more of our patrons are receptive to YouTube. And, you know, one of the things that we were concerned with early on, which this 4th of July event helped us to overcome our thinking on, mm-hmm. was, you know, we are the Waterbury Symphony Orchestra. How do we compete with all this content mm-hmm. being put out by the larger organizations, which is just in a totally different category of its own? But what I've discovered, Pam, is I think at the end of the day, a lot of our patrons, and I think this is true in a lot of communities, they want to support what's in their community,
right.
because they recognize during this period the importance of community. And for me, that's been reinforced during this whole pandemic. You know, it's a period defined by isolation and being separated and distanced. And yet, even in that, in this period defined by those things, I see this emerging sense of community. And I think that's, for me, is the sort of silver lining of this pandemic, is this emerging sense of community and togetherness. And I think it's that sentiment that will help to sustain organizations like ours in a community where the orchestra for more than 82 years now has mm-hmm. been an important facet of the community's life.
So with that same regard, do you think that since COVID, your donors have come out more in force than before COVID?
I mean,
Absolutely. Really feeling the threat of perhaps losing this great community orchestra. As you say, 82 years is a long time. That's a big investment. You don't want to see this die at this point.
Our donors have been incredibly generous, both individually and institutionally, and a lot of it starts with our board. Every year we do something called Give Local, which is an annual regional day of giving that is, well, it's actually 2 days of giving sponsored by the Connecticut Community Foundation. We exceeded the total for every year prior this year.
Wow.
And again, I think that speaks to the generosity of the people who can give right now are giving, but even on a much more fundamental level, we received more than, you know, we had 2 major concerts canceled, Pam, as well as a smaller concert We received more than $10,000 in tickets donated back.
Fantastic.
We have a very small amount of refunds compared to that.
That is absolutely fantastic. Yeah. And this is due in part to you. I mean, you really have come into the symphony orchestra and shaken things up a little bit. You've raised everyone's awareness, and you've kept the level so high. I think there's definitely a feeling of pride here that they're supporting. And in that same way, let's talk about your music and medicine initiative. Mm. I think this is something really interesting that the Waterbury Symphony has started.
Well, I think, again, it speaks to how essential the arts are. And that's not only something that, you know, is an opinion, but it's scientifically backed. Mm-hmm. That music heals us. And music has certain abilities to activate our brain that mm-hmm. science is still figuring out. So this is an area that we've had some, I would say, growing interest in. Mm-hmm. We have several doctors that are either current or former board members, including our former board chair, who for many years was a senior member of the Waterbury Hospital and clinical faculty at the Yale School of Medicine. So we decided this year, really right before the pandemic, we actually launched an initiative around music and medicine with an inaugural conference at the Naugatuck Valley Community College. Pam, I know you've been there. That's our mm-hmm. venue mm-hmm. where we are orchestra in residence. And the conference really focused, it was a little more broad-based, but the common theme was music healing us and music creating these cognitive connections in a way that I don't think other art forms, you know, I'm not sure actually, you know, again, I don't want to speak out of turn, but I think music is activating the brain, and there's a certain amount of phenomenon that's still being discovered. So we launched an initiative in February. We had several doctors speak on the topic, including Dr. Marvin McMillan, who is, he's done a lot of some programs with Renee Fleming, actually, on music and medicine. He's mm-hmm. a Connecticut resident. We have Dr. Vincent DeLuise, former board member, and Dr. Jim Flint, who's a former board chair, helping us to really champion this initiative. The timing, you know, it was great that we were able to have the inaugural conference right before the pandemic. We didn't want this to suddenly come to a stop because of the pandemic. So we've managed to continue this initiative through virtual offerings that have looked at things, for example, the cognitive benefits of Bach. We hear so much about the Mozart effect, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But actually Bach's music has also been studied because of the relationship that it has to our cognitive function.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I've done a show on this before, and I think it's so important that you're bearing this out because, you know, more and more we're going to have to establish the importance of the arts, and especially through music, by relating it to medicine, to science, and what is happening with the brain. You know, it's something that those diehard people who don't really want to support the arts, who are dragging their heels thinking, well, they're not really essentials. They need to look at this. And the facts are out there. And, you know, you talk about hot housing babies and, of course, the Mozart effect. But we know for a fact that listening to Bach helps young children with linear kind of difficulties and working out linear things in their brain. So, you know, it's so important. I mean, just on that simple scientific level. Now, let's talk about now just the enjoyment of music. You know, you see people working all week and they're looking forward to coming to one of your concerts, and now they're deprived, you know, but yet you could still be innovative online. And something in me is saying, this is our future now. I think we need to embrace online a little more than we were at the beginning. I know a lot of musicians were saying, no, I die hard, live music or nothing. And I think we need to really, really bend a little bit with that, you know, because we may be in this situation for a while, especially in America, as we try to see COVID, you know, you come to grips with it. And gatherings are going to be, it's going to take a big leap of, confidence to get us back together in a room. Well, I think this is tremendous what you've done so far. Robert. I think it's absolutely wonderful. I watched a few of your educational people online with the Carnival of the Animals. I loved it, the way they introduced the instruments. I thought it came across so well. And I think if we can just, you know, keep educating everybody out there that this is here and take advantage of it, you know, and along the way, let's donate some money to keep it alive. I know that you have been affected as many others in that, you know, we're all fearful of not being able to pay the rent. And I'm sure that Waterbury in its own way is going to help with the education of artist relief funds and, you know, getting the word out to everyone who works with you. Would I be right in that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. No, I think, you know, when I look at what we're doing, it's for me, it's about what we're doing for our community. But I always hope that the work that we do can set an example for others and can maybe help to create innovation and to teach others. Because I think it's so important that we all work together and collaborate and share resources and ideas and help to raise awareness, not only on our own, but collectively during this period.
And you are doing that with the Waterbury Symphony Orchestra, Robert Chinanti. I love having you on my show. You are always a force to be reckoned
with. I love coming on the show.
And here you are, a singer in this heavy arts administration job with an orchestra. I love that. Keep doing it, Robert Chinanti. And I want everyone to go to Waterbury Symphony Orchestra. Is it .org?
Waterbury Symphony? WaterburySymphony.org.
.org. And do your best to support this fantastic group. Robert, I want to thank you again. Come on anytime. Recheck in with me in 6 months and we'll see where we're at with COVID. And I really hope that we're looking at a future where we're all back together. And if we're not, we're going to find it online. So you keep doing your job. And thank you.
Thanks,
for
Pam.
It. All right.
Thank you.
This is Pamela.
Stay well.
This is Pamela Kuhn. I hope you'll go to centerstagewithpamelakuhn.com for more information on my show and my blogs. And thank you, Robert Chinanti. And now the curtain is down on Center Stage.